Hello, everybody. This is one more episode of Language Bits, and today we have a special guest. This is a dear friend of mine, so I'll let him introduce himself. So, hi, Brett.
Hello.
Could you tell us who you are and how we met and whatever, so that people know who you are?
Hi, Marion. Thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here. So my name is Brad Hillis. I'm British-Australian. Currently living in the Netherlands, studying my master's. And I've been teaching for a few years, and this is also how we actually know each other. Short-term teaching position in the UK.
Right, definitely. Well, tell us a little bit about your master's. What are you studying at the moment?
So I'm doing a two-year master's called Philosophy of Science, Technology and Society. It's mostly actually philosophy of technology. Philosophy of science is just a small part of it. And in a nutshell, it's basically how we talk about technology's impact on society, what kind of effects come from its use, what kind of ethical questions does it raise, and all kinds of other things like that. So we discuss emerging technologies or technologies already in society and many other related issues.
Sounds interesting and hard.
Yeah. Well, the other way that I like to explain it is, have you seen Black Mirror? It's just like that.
Yes, I have. Oh, come on. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, it sounds even harder than I thought before. It's like...
and more terrifying.
Yeah, exactly. That's the very word. Terrifying. You know, how would someone sign up for that?
For the course, you mean?
That's exactly
for the dystopian future that we're all inevitably heading towards.
Definitely. Okay. Fantastic. So when are you going to finish it?
Well, hopefully within about 8 months, I'd say, because we have to do the master's thesis, of course. And yeah, it depends how quickly I can get that done.
Are you satisfied with the work so far that you've done?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's fantastic. It's absolutely the right course for me. You know, this is why I've ended up in kind of an obscure Dutch town, because as soon as I saw the course, I knew it was exactly what I wanted to do. So absolutely no regrets about that.
That's wonderful.
It's been a lot of work. It's been intense, but yeah, it's absolutely where I should be, I think.
That's great. And then you moved from the UK to the Netherlands in order to do it.
Yeah, that's right.
Great. What do you think of university life so far? Because I'm sure you're studying with many foreigners. Maybe most of them are not even Dutch, or are they? How's that?
Mostly Dutch, yeah, but we do have an international mix. We have quite a few Germans. Germany is actually about 10Ks down the road.
Okay.
So plenty of German students, Italians. Yeah, the experience has been fantastic. It's been really different from my undergraduate experience. Because the class size is significantly smaller than what I was used to in my undergrad. We're a class of about 15 or 16 people. Mm-hmm. So we've managed to build a really, really tight bond amongst us. And I've never met such a motivated group of students. Like, it's been fantastic.
That sounds great. Wow. Okay. And the language of the course is English. So you don't speak Dutch, or neither do they?
Well, they speak Dutch because they are mostly Dutch.
In the course. The course is not taught in Dutch, is it?
Yeah, the course is all in English. Yeah. Which is another reason why I have a huge amount of respect for my classmates, because philosophy is a tough subject, even in your native language.
Of course.
So for them to be doing it in their second language, I just have a huge amount of respect for them.
They're Dutch, we have to remember. It is probably not the second. It might be the fourth or fifth language. Yep. But who's counting anyway, you know? So they're Dutch.
Absolutely, yeah. But the level of English in the country is fantastic in general anyway.
It's great, isn't it? Yeah, we've had that experience too with the Dutch student during the summer, right? So he was different from the others in terms of how much he could achieve, right? It was amazing. He used to be a student, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we had a few of them actually.
Mm-hmm. True.
And yeah, you could tell that they came from their English experiences were a little bit different from the rest of their classmates.
Yeah,
you definitely get that impression.
Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, I'd like to go back and focus on you a little bit more. I'd like to know, because we're both teachers, and what I would like to know from you is, when did you first realize that you wanted to teach?
Well, I think there was probably not a single moment of realization. I think it was a gradual thing that built up over the years. And I think that came from just the kind of gratification I would get from just the experience of teaching something.
You didn't really mind what it was back then. It could be anything. So English was just casual, that you weren't like teaching it.
Yeah. I mean, especially in university, like studying things like philosophy and politics, it involves a lot of discussion. And so I think, over time, I realized that the act of trying to tutor someone or help them to understand something was quite a gratifying experience, because it meant that I really had to understand it myself.
And otherwise, you wouldn't think about it, right? Because it's your own language, so you would not even think of it, would you?
And then in terms of teaching as a profession, I think this is something that really started to develop once I graduated from university. So one of the first things I did was I did some training with a charity which teaches philosophy to kids. Well, not teachers per se, but they facilitate philosophical discussions in primary schools. And this was one of the first things I did after graduating. And I think this is probably the beginnings of my realization that it's something that I could do professionally.
Okay. But back then, did you think you would be, what was the profession then? Were you training to be what? It's not a philosopher? What is that? It's like a scientist? What were you aiming to be back then?
Well, with that particular charity, this is more you act as a facilitator of discussion for these like 1 hour sessions in classrooms. But at the time, you know, when you're a fresh graduate, you don't necessarily have some really strong ideas about what you want your career to be. During that time, I was still kind of figuring out what to do next. And it seemed like a logical thing for me to do, having just graduated from philosophy.
I see. What other professions did you contemplate, or what other jobs did you do before you decided, oh, I'm going to teach?
For many years, I've harbored aspirations to be a writer, which is something I still spend a lot of time
doing.
And great. Aspiring to.
Why not, so I right? Did,
yeah, exactly. It's something I still really enjoy doing.
It's funny you mentioned this, because I think this is a common desire for most teachers that I know.
Yeah.
All of them say, I scribble here and there, and then I have my own writers, my own short stories, and they hope to be published at some point. You know, so, you know, it's quite common, actually. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, there always seems to be a bit of a correlation between teachers and writers.
I guess, yeah.
So I definitely fit the mold in that respect.
And what else?
After I graduated from uni, I did lean towards working in the environmental sector. So I wanted to get involved somehow. I didn't necessarily have an eye on a particular position, but I just wanted to work. And I ended up working at an environmental charity.
It seems that you did a bit of charity work back then, both with philosophy and now with environment.
Yeah. And this wasn't by design. It was just, it just happened that way.
Wow.
And what was actually began as a voluntary position with an environmental charity turned into a managerial position and a job that lasted 2.5 years, I think.
Nice. Yeah. Okay.
And then English teaching came later.
Okay. Did you quit that job as a manager, or what happened? Okay.
Yeah.
Right. We're no longer satisfied after a while.
I just got the travel bug, really. I just started daydreaming about doing a long trip. This is actually where the English
teaching came along. Okay. Okay. I imagine. I reckon that many people who are native speakers of English and who are in their own countries, they decide to teach English so that they can live abroad. Is that what happened to you?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. Because I wanted to work and travel at the same time. And if you do even the slightest bit of research on working and traveling, then teaching English comes up again and again as a viable option in countries all over the world. So it seemed seemed like a thing to do. So when I was working, I did a CELTA part-time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of my key that I took with me when I went traveling. And yeah, it's, went on to find positions in Asia.
Okay. I was going to ask you just that. So right after you've got CELTA, so what parts of the world did you want to go to? So that was Asia. That's what you were wanted to do at back then.
Yeah, well, I did just a bit of traveling on my bicycle for about a year. And then when I started to feel like I wanted to get back to the working world, but still wanted to travel. Asia was in the forefront of my mind.
I'm sorry, but you can't just casually mention that you were biking around the world, just like as if it were an important or an interesting.
Oh, you know, as you
just
do.
Just have to talk about it. Yeah, see,
just one of those year-long bike rides. Everybody does that, right?
Yeah, of course. Don't we all, right? So I'm sorry, how to talk about this. So biking around the world. So was it on a gap year? What was it, something like that, or how was it?
Well, it's, you know, when I was working at the charity, I spent about a year saving up. I always wanted, I liked the idea of doing an overland trip, and originally had wanted to do it on a motorbike, but, you know, costs... The fact that I didn't have a license for one was a bit of a restriction. And then when I realized I could do it.
You just took a shortcut, right?
Took a shortcut, yeah.
Right, of course.
Bike's much easier. And then, yeah, so that turned into a year-long trip cycling through Europe.
And where did you go?
So I went from, started in France, and then over into Switzerland, and into Italy.
Wow.
Didn't stay very long in Italy, just cycled down to Milan and then flew over to Egypt.
Oh, wow.
And then the plan was to cycle from Cairo to Cape Town.
Oh, wow.
Actually,
you're ambitious. I can give you that.
Yeah. But then, you know, no plan survives first contact with reality. Mm-hmm. So it actually
How
ended
far
up...
did you go?
Well, yeah. When did you fail? Is what you're asking.
No, I never said that. But you know, anyway, when did you stop? I would say because, as you said, reality crashes at some point.
Well, it ended up being a mix of cycling and transport. So train, cycling, bus, cycling, and then when I got to Rwanda, I decided, I wanted to move on. So I ended up cutting the trip, that part of the trip short, and flying over to Australia, and then. I did met up with a few people and cycled from the west coast to the east, and that was the end of the cycling. But yeah, it was a fantastic way to finish the trip.
Okay, but you know, Australia is not exactly a small continent, so it might have taken like probably the biggest part of the trip itself.
Pretty big, yeah. It took 6 weeks all in all. But actually, our daily mileage was the highest at any point in the trip. We averaged about 100 kilometers per day. Wow, so I think we got through it pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Were you working during this time or not really? Were you living off the money you had saved?
Well, I was doing some farm work in Australia.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. But you only started working when you got to Australia, not before?
Yeah, that was the first time I started working on the trip, on the farm.
Okay, fine.
Up until then, I've just been living off savings.
All right, great. Okay. Well, if I were in your shoes, really, if once I returned, I would say, okay, I've seen enough of the world. Let me just stay put and find my professional, whatever this is. It's amazing that after so much traveling, you would go like, okay, now I want to find a profession that allows me to travel even more. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Okay. Although really it's, you know, even though China is exotic and it's still traveling in my mind, like I did settle. I rented an apartment, so I was at least grounded and could build up more of a community than I did when I was on the road. That's why it was a good combination for me, because it's still an adventure, but you know, good to be back in the working world.
Sorry to interrupt you. Let me just see if I got this right then. So you took yourself, it was after the trip? The cycling trip, or did you take the CELTA before it?
Oh, the CELTA was before the cycling trip. Yeah, while I was still in London, I was doing the CELTA part time whilst I worked at the charity.
Oh, okay, right.
So basically, I was cycling around the world with my CELTA certificate in my back pocket, literally.
Oh, I see. Because you might just get a job. You thought it might happen. So
yeah.
Just in case.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I see. But then the first job you actually landed was in China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Okay.
Once you had come back to London, or did you get it while you were in Australia?
Oh, well, I interviewed and got offered the job while I was in Australia.
Right.
And I had planned on just going straight to China, but because I hadn't seen my family in a year, they mm-hmm. very kindly offered to pay for my flight home.
Oh, lovely.
So I took them up on that, obviously, and spent about 6 weeks back home before moving on to China. Yeah.
Okay. And how was the experience teaching and living in China?
Oh, it was incredible. Yeah. It was so many new things for me, so many firsts. The first time I was teaching professionally, getting paid to. The first time I've really worked with children, because this was kids and teens who I was teaching.
Okay, what was the age group, more or less?
My age group ranged from 3 years old to my oldest students were 16, 17.
Okay, very young. Did you get any specific training to teach very young children?
We did, yeah. We had quite a thorough onboarding process in Shanghai. Taking us through the techniques and some of the issues you might come up against when working with such young children.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't totally thrown into the deep end, but even so, it's one of those things that you just have to do eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Get over your reluctance. But no, it was a fantastic experience.
Oh, great. It sounds fantastic. What were like the most challenging parts of that? Because I reckon it might be quite different to, you know, to be a Londoner and then go live in China. Mm-hmm. Might be mind blowing, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, in terms of adapting to the culture, I didn't find that too difficult. Maybe because I'd already had a year of traveling behind me, like going to another culture and learning new habits and practices was kind of
just like a walk in the park.
Like
for
a walk
you.
In the park, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
And then right. Once you get into the classroom, even though you do have this language barrier, it all comes down to classroom management, and that's going to be very similar wherever you are in the world. You know, they're mm-hmm. little kids. They're even though it's a different country, they're kids. They're excitable. They're boisterous and.
Of course. Yeah,
really, it just comes down to classroom management. And that was something that I learned on the job.
Of course. There is only so much preparation you can get, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Even in the best courses, that's so true.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And what was the most rewarding part for you then?
So working in China or teaching in general?
I think basically I'm interested in this moment in your experience in China first. So let's have an idea of what that experience was like.
Well, I think it was just being exposed to a different culture in that way, because you really, by working somewhere, you do get a unique perspective on another country, on another culture. You really get a different view on the kind of the dynamism of the place and, into the kind of, the psyche of people.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, to a certain degree, kids are kids, and
sure.
They can be frustrating, but some mm-hmm. days they can also fill you with energy.
Mm-hmm.
I think actually that would be one of my favorite parts of the job, is sometimes before a class, you would just feel, you don't have the energy for it. You're not in the mood. Just like to do anything but teach. But then when you do it, you have an hour with them, and these kids can just energize you because they're so full of joy and they're so happy mm-hmm. to see their teacher. And you can come out of the class like a totally different person than you were an hour ago. And those would be my favorite kinds of days, because it's...
That's true. That's true. And that's definitely different when it comes to adults, right?
Yeah, I think so. Because you bring a different energy level when you're teaching adults, definitely. Mm-hmm.
And you have to do most of the work to get the bond and then to get them started, right? It is you trying to encourage them, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's quite different. The motivation is a different game when you're teaching adults, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. How similar do you find teaching children and very young children like you did and teenagers? How similar or different are the experiences?
Yeah, well, I think, again, a lot of it is to do with energy and how you engage them. So obviously with really small children, you want your lessons to be, you want to break them down into short chunks because their attention span is not going to be as good as...
it's not marvelous, yeah, sure.
Yeah, so you want them to be, yeah, these short bursts, a variation of activities. You want lots of physical, lots of physicality in the classroom, TPR, lots of aids, visual aids, like toys and puppets and flashcards and technology. Some of those you will carry over into your classes with teenagers, but you can tone it down a little bit.
Of course. It's interesting that I was wondering, in the back of my mind, I was like, when are we going to address anything remotely similar to what we see in CELTA, you know? Because it's quite interesting. We were talking about energy levels, and again, you're not prepared for those things when you're taking a course. Right, you just hope for the best, but you have no idea. This is not something that anyone tells you. Even the most experienced teacher will never let you know, look, it's all about the energy levels. You have to bring in the energy. No one tells you these things when you're studying, when you're training. It's like quite interesting.
And I think some of the techniques you learn in CELTA, you can apply them quite successfully with children. Things like spotlighting, for example. Don't give a handout to everyone in the class and then explain the handout because no one will be listening to you. They'll be looking at the handout. You want to hold it in front of them so everyone's watching. Like these are basic things. And that's these are one of those techniques which is true for smallest children and adults as well, because that's just humans. That's how we are.
Because if you mess up, you learn the hard way that you shouldn't have done it. So true. Yes, we definitely learn it. And I think it works across cultures. It's just so incredible. As you said, it's just about teaching humans, regardless of where they come from. It's the same.
Exactly.
It is amazing. Fantastic. Okay. Well, now speaking in more general terms, what do you think are the most, the best and the worst part of teaching in general?
Well, for me, the best part is just about people. It's about meeting people, especially in teaching English. You get the opportunity to meet people from all over the world. And that's just, that's just fascinating to me. Because you're all, you're unified in this game aim of learning English, but people's reasons for wanting to do that, their motivations, they're all different. And like I said, always have a bit of a travel bug, and so just the opportunity to meet people of all ages and all backgrounds is just it's just really exciting. It really gives your working life dynamism and a variation that I guess you don't get in every job.
Of course, English becomes just your excuse, right? It's your official excuse to get to bond with people, right, in the end.
Exactly.
That's it. Because of course they need it. It's the practical reason why they're there. But you get to really know people sometimes even quite deeply. Right?
You build relationships.
It is quite interesting. And English lessons, or language lessons for that matter, are quite interesting in the sense that they can be lessons about virtually anything. If you're interested in technology, it could be about that. If you're interested in arts, if you're interested in whatever you take an interest in, it could be about that. You just use the language as a tool to talk about what you actually want to talk about. So
Exactly. Yeah, it's a means to explore other ideas and other concepts and topics.
I don't think physics teachers or mathematics teachers have it that easy in that particular concern. So it's quite interesting. It's easier that way.
Absolutely.
Definitely. All right. Do you see yourself teaching in the future? Or because now you're continuing your studies, so I suppose you might want to do something different in the future.
Well, really, I think it's something that I will always come back to.
Great.
Because, like I said, it's something I find really personally gratifying. I think the only question is how long I'll spend teaching English. Because, I have a lot of interests and I really like the idea of teaching subjects that I can really get my teeth into, like things like philosophy and history and politics. So I think teaching as a profession is something that it'll always be in my life. It's just a question of what I'm teaching. That I think that'll change over time.
Mm-hmm. Of course. And if I may be so bold, let's get the cat out of the bag, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is really about the very low paychecks, right? When you teach English, that's the thing.
Yeah.
If they paid more, probably we would take the profession more seriously, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So and yeah, as right now I'm doing all of my teaching online. And so I'm seeing, yeah, the huge discrepancies in,
of course,
in how much you're paid.
Yeah.
So you've really got to be discerning when you're, you know, looking for new contracts online.
Of course.
You've really got to pick carefully, definitely.
Because otherwise you will only find out what you've done once you cannot change anything, right? It's just so bad while you're in the job. So it's like, So there is always a term that you have to fulfill, like, okay, 6 months or whatever. So, yeah, it can get quite tricky. Yeah,
absolutely.
And even the right is honest, if we're just speaking bluntly. Yeah. So you have to be careful. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, how different do you find teaching online to teaching a face-to-face class? Which one is more interesting for you for the moment you're in right now in your life?
Yeah, well, they're very different. They can be very different animals. Mm-hmm. In terms of where I am in my life, it's just super convenient. You know, it really fits in with my life because it's very flexible.
Mm-hmm. Teaching online, you mean, right?
Teaching online, yeah.
Okay.
So it's super convenient in terms of where I am now because mm-hmm. I can fit it alongside my studies without too much interference.
Mm-hmm.
In many respects, it's much easier. You don't have any of these issues with classroom management, like I was talking about before.
So true, yeah.
And in other respects, it's more difficult, mm-hmm. especially with teaching English. The big thing that you lose in one-on-one online teaching English is student interaction, because you don't have any. You don't have any student-to-student interaction, and that is a big drawback in terms of teaching English, because that's one of your most powerful tools when you're teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, it's just one-on-one. But on the other hand, that means you can get constant direct feedback to the student.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You can really hone in on things like pronunciation, and you can really dig into the point of whatever language focus that you have.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you mentioned that, because for me, when I'm teaching online, something that it has that I've been empowered to do is that you don't have to be doing so much traveling anymore, because you can get to know people from virtually, and you can teach people from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, for me, it's very exciting to have a student in Peru, for example, another one in Chile, and another one in Italy, and another one in Australia, wherever they are, which is so nice, you know. So of course we have the time zones to consider and everything, but it's quite nice too, because you get the different experiences. So I don't feel exactly like I do, if I'm honest, you know, because I don't feel that we lose so much of the human, you know, contact. Of course, it's not physical, but it's there, you know. The topics are the same, the conversation. It's all about, you know, bonding with the people and, you know, building up from there, I think.
Oh, no, absolutely. No, you do still get that, definitely. And like I was saying before, the element of just meeting new people, like, it's probably even better teaching online, because, like you said, you just... you know, just open the window, and then in one morning you can talk to someone in Korea and China, South America. Mm-hmm. Like, so all of that is still there, that human element. Mm-hmm. The only thing I feel is missing is student to student interaction. They can't practice the language with anyone except me.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Unless of course you're teaching groups online, in which case you do have that.
Mm-hmm. Right. I see where you're coming from now. It was not clear to me, because you used to live in the UK. And of course, for students coming into the UK and studying with native speakers, it makes complete sense that they are immersed in the experience.
Mm.
But it's not, for example, the experience I had, because as you know, I used to teach in Brazil. People wouldn't be in touch with English anyway,
mm-hmm.
because they're living in a Portuguese-speaking country. So the only moment they had with English was with me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it happens all around the world when you mm-hmm. live in a non-English-speaking country.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it from that perspective. Nice.
Yeah. Well, because when you teach adults, it's just baked into the lesson plan that you will have people pairing off or in groups to practice mm-hmm. the language amongst themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so making the transition from that to one-to-one online, You do have to change things up a little bit. But...
Yeah, of course, the dynamics of it. Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Have you taught groups online already, more than one student, or just one-on-one lessons?
Most of my classes are one-on-one, but I do have some groups, and so you do have that option again to pair people off and have them talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
But again, one of the drawbacks is if you were doing this in real life, you would be able to walk around the classroom and actually listen closely to people talking, and then do your delayed error correction.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really do that when people are talking in groups online. You just have to try and, you know, really mm-hmm. listen carefully and try and pick out the conversations and the errors.
There are moments you can just leave them alone a little bit, and for 2 or 3 minutes you can just actually grab your coffee and
yeah.
not actually be correcting all the time.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. you can see things as a drawback or just as an advantage, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just different. Yeah, we have to adapt to whatever tools we've got, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it does, what I do like about teaching in these different formats is that it forces you to rethink, is to always improve yourself and think how you're going to do it. Because I think one of the biggest kind of challenges with teaching English is that it's very easy to rest on your laurels and
mm-hmm.
Be complacent with how you do it.
People sure.
get into their habits and they think, well, what works, and there's no point in doing things differently.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that's one of the biggest challenges, is just forcing yourself to constantly improve, because there's always, always room for improvement.
Mm-hmm.
And so teaching in these different formats can push you into doing that.
Absolutely. And there is always this creative element, right? If you're not creating while you're teaching, you're dead.
Yeah.
And probably your classes suck, if we're honest.
Exactly.
Not creating. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you won't even realize that they suck.
Yes. We've all had this, more than teachers, we've all had those kinds of professors, right? Because it happens so much at uni, right? It's just that. Yeah. So we've all been there, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, to end up on a high note, I suppose, I would like to know, what are your professional accomplishments that you're most proud of?
Mm. Well, hopefully many of my biggest professional accomplishments are still ahead of me.
So far, that's what I mean.
So far, I would say, mm-hmm. I was talking about the charity that I mm-hmm. used to work at. For me, it was totally unexpected that I would progress from where I started, because I started as an intern, mm-hmm. a lowly intern. They didn't make me get the coffee or anything, but it was
great. Thank the Lord.
It was so that was only meant to be a temporary position, but mm-hmm. so I was working with volunteers,
mm-hmm.
Helping to manage volunteers, and I ended up really building a rapport with them, and you know, I was entrusted with more and more responsibilities. And that eventually turned into a paid position and then a managerial position.
Okay.
And this was not a plan. It was totally unexpected. So for me, this was a real, you know, validation that I really could do something if I dedicated myself to it, and I could be acknowledged for it and rewarded. And yeah, I've always been proud of that.
Mm-hmm, definitely. This is great. And of course, as you said, this is quite early for you in your career to rest on your laurels right now. Yeah. So let's mm-hmm. give it a couple of decades or so, you know, so that I can ask you the question again and see what you think then.
Yeah. When you're doing episode number 5012, you can do this again.
Yes, absolutely. So let's see. Yes, whatever season that is, if that gets too long. You know what? If I'm actually successful, who knows, one day we can upgrade this into YouTube. I don't know. No. We can't do this conveniently over the internet, you know, just have to travel or get to you, get to me. So we have proper coffee or something in a nice lighted setting, you know?
Yeah, or maybe we'll just do holograms by then.
I don't know, you're just too inventive, you know. You had to be a teacher, you know, with this kind of creativity, you know. But definitely, yes. Right, Brad. So I guess that's what I wanted to ask you. Really, do you have any final remarks to give to our listeners?
Keep learning.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, I have students, right, that are going to listen. So just keep learning, you know. If it's hard, just carry on, you know.
Yeah, keep no. Well, let me. I don't want to be so brief. But no, I would say so. The way that I approach teaching is especially teaching English, is I always say to students, the most important thing is communication. Mm-hmm. Students are always worried about accuracy, but for me, accuracy is a secondary thing. The first thing should be communicating. Just get your meaning across. Say what you're trying to say.
So true.
Because you would be surprised how much you can communicate with what you know. You know? But if you're making pronunciation errors or mistakes with grammar, that's okay. We can work on those, but it's not the ball game. You know, get the ball over the net. Just try and communicate, and then accuracy is secondary. That's what I always say to my students.
Absolutely true. You know what? I was actually having a conversation with Brazilian students the other day, and they said, it's something that I've never really paid attention to, but according to them, that you do have some nationalities, and Brazil is a little bit like that. People feel very awkward or ashamed when they're speaking English, you know, around all the Brazilians, which is funny. Mm-hmm. You know, they should feel it's more difficult when you're talking to a native speaker, but because there is a little bit of a competition, I should sound perfect, I should sound a certain way. And that's what keeps them from actually just, you know, feeling that they can actually, it's a safe space for experimentation and for learning and for growth. So it kind of holds them back. And it's a little bit sad if you think about it, because people should feel more at ease. It's just, in a learning process, you know, it don't have to be perfect.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is something that you figure out when you go from teaching children to teaching adults, is that adults have internalized that kind of competition and that shame element a lot more than kids. Kids are much, much more ready to fall on their faces and get it wrong. Mm. Like, that's great. That's what we need. You know, you need to experiment and make errors and
not afraid from making mistakes. That's it. All right. So maybe we should tell the students, don't be afraid of making mistakes and don't try to avoid them altogether, because they're precious. They're going to make you learn even more.
Exactly. Okay, yeah, we learn by mistakes.
Marvelous. That's it. All right, my friend. Thank you so much for this interview. And
you're
welcome.
Wish
you all the best and everything. And hopefully we'll meet down the line, hopefully sooner than later.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And yeah, I hope I see you again soon, not in hologram form.
Yes, definitely not. Mm-hmm. All right, Brad, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.